How many of you know that George Washington was a Freemason? How many of you know if you're a Freemason, you cannot possibly in your wildest dreams be a Christian? It's absolutely impossible. And I can show it to you in their own words. So how could George Washington be a Christian? And you don't even know the slightest, teeniest bit about his real involvement in the secret societies. He founded a military order, a secret order of his military officers, the generals and senior officers of the Revolution. What's the name of that order? The Knights? Of Cincinnatus, also known as the Knights of the Golden Circle. What sprang out of the Knights of the Golden Circle many years later? The Ku Klux Klan. How many of you knew that? How many of you knew that when Benjamin Franklin was in the colonies, he pretended to be a pious Christian, although he was not seen in church too much, pretended to be a pious Christian. However, he entered into a sexual relationship and a living arrangement with two different women and sired children by both of them, never married either one. How many of you knew that? How many of you knew that when Benjamin Franklin went to France, he surrounded himself with prostitutes and drank champagne almost 24 hours a day? And just reveled in orgies. How many of you knew that? You'd be surprised what some ugly old men are capable of. See, these are things you don't know because you were taught something different, and it makes you uncomfortable to hear what I'm telling you, only for the reason that you've been taught something else and you've been reared with it and you've accepted it. It's hard to let go of something that you have learned and accepted that is not true. You don't want to let go of it, because then you have to give up your comfort zone.
So, it's Friday. It's 5 o'clock. Welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling. Helping me review this week's news is Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. And also we'll be hearing clips from Lib Dem councillor for Knowle, Gary Hopkins. He's the father of Julian Assange, after the 6 o'clock news. But don't be surprised if you haven't heard his name. John Shipton has been almost ignored by the London media in this globally important case about freedom of the press. Julian Assange on trial. In an exclusive interview with him tonight, he talks about Julian's misspent youth, his hopes for the case, and the incredible UC Global case, where a private spying company revealed a US obsession with hacking into Julian's life in the Ecuadorian embassy. Also, in case you hadn't noticed, it's the 19th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks. Today, we hear from Arizona talk show host, former US Naval Intelligence Officer William Cooper. He was killed 8 weeks after the 9/11 attacks by undercover FBI agents. And his show from the 28th of June 2001, 10 weeks before 9/11, all but predicts the 9/11 false flag attack on America, and that it will be blamed on Osama bin Laden. He, by the way, was the prototype for the doppelganger Alex Jones, who might sound similar, broadcasting from neighbouring Texas, but Jones has none of the military insight, except that which he's fed from Rita Katz and Mossad, and just uses his show now to bash Muslims in lockstep with NATO intelligence services. So we hear from the genuine version tonight, the Hour of the Times, Bill Cooper, predicting 9/11 just before it happened on the airwaves in the US. And they say 6 people per bubble, 6 feet apart, and 6 months between lockdowns. 10:30 until 4 p.m. on Monday, they'll be outside Bristol Council House on College Green protesting against no more than 6 social meeting rules. It's Stand Up X Bristol. And we're here tonight from, not to forget, HS2, another protest movement in the movement against 5G has a new member, the super wealthy former president of Microsoft Canada. So stand by for seeing the 5G campaign taking off. And a medieval satanic group. We've had clips from David Livingstone over the last couple of weeks. Another one this week, infiltrating all the monotheistic faiths, hell-bent on privatising the earth so they can buy it up for their own private property, author of The Dying God. We heard from him also last week, giving his view on the origins of the fake Jewish Kabbalah again tonight. And one of the world's best scholars, I think, and authors on the topic, the author of Transhumanism, The History of a Dangerous Idea, really looking at the modern fascism, David Livingstone. More on the Kabbalah at the heart of fake Christian America and their plan today for chaos and madness to bring about a one world totalitarian government. Some say a new world order, the great plan coming to fruition possibly quite soon in a town near you. But to review this week's news, the local and national stuff to begin with is Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. Hi Martin, welcome to the Politics Show.
Hello.
So we're going to start, I think, by going straight to Prime Minister's questions for a change. But I know you've been back at school this week. How's things there? And it's actually really lovely to see school children coming backwards and forwards from school this week for the first time for months. Well, it is, isn't it? 6 months or so.
Well, it's not quite the same. For example, there are no lunches in the canteen. Everybody's got to bring in a packed lunch, and those who are on free school meals, they get a packed lunch from the school, but nobody's got, you know, we're not using the main hall.
So the dinner ladies, the dinner men, or whoever they are no longer being employed?
Well, I don't know what's actually happening about that, to be honest with you, but they're certainly not dishing out hot dinners.
It's interesting, isn't it, that so many things seem to have been used as an excuse to completely cut them. Surely, I mean, you can prepare food. Obviously, that's an essential service. I would have thought that should stay, but one can't be a cynic like me and look at saying, in things like the National Health Service, getting rid of actual face-to-face meetings with doctors, etc., and in the education service, getting rid of school meals. This is just an excuse to cut the service.
Well, I mean, since the whole thing is that every class in primary schools is a bubble, you can't have loads of classes all together in the canteen. Otherwise, we might as well just function as we did before. And that's not happening. I'm just flagging up that certain things aren't the same. That, for example, is a pretty clear example of something that isn't the same as it was before.
But couldn't you just have, bubbles going through one at a time?
No. It's difficult enough as it is, because each class has to come in 10 minutes between each class, and the parents have to be there exactly on time, and they all have to leave in a staggered way as well, so we don't get big... I mean, basically, people used to hang around outside the school gates and chat to their mates, and that's all been, cut back. I mean, we're functioning in a very different way than we did previously.
Are we going to go back to normal when this virus goes away?
Well, in theory, I presume we are, but of course, we're not back to normal yet, so there we are.
Well, the virus has gone away, although there are lots of people testing positive. Certainly, it's not killing odd anyone. I think we're down at the figures of 5 deaths with COVID-19. That is nobody actually dying at all of COVID-19 itself, people dying with it, which is just around about the normal death rate. And so there's a very strong argument, and the stand-up Bristol People meeting in College Green between 10:30 and 4 on Monday, that's basically what they're saying, is that we've got to go back to normal. What's the problem? The pandemic's finished. It finished in June. This is their argument.
Well, it may be their argument, but I think if you look at opinion polls, that's not the majority view in this country or anywhere else.
In the US, two-thirds, I was reading this week, of people say they're not going to have the vaccine in the US.
Well, that's a different question, isn't it? I mean, people would say they wouldn't want the vaccine for all sorts of reasons.
Are they mostly, we've got 66% of Americans anti-vaxxers?
Well, that may be so, Tony, and if they find a vaccine, which of course they haven't got yet, then those 66% will have to consider whether they're going to have it or not.
Trump has said he's going to have one ready for the November election.
Well, of course, and Kamala Harris and Biden have said that's rushing it because you're not doing the relevant tests. And, of course, in other words, they've come out as anti-vaxxers if it's Trump's vaccine. So there you go.
This whole term anti-vaxxer is, I think, a little bit overused, because you can be somewhere in between, can't you? You can say, well, certain vaccines I would take and others I wouldn't.
Well, I've been vaccinated as an adult. When I first went to Russia in the 70s, we were told to take tetanus vaccines, and so on. And anybody who's travelled like, you know, on their gap year or whatever, you go and have a series of vaccines before you set off.
I think, you know, basically people have got to be convinced that it's worth doing rather than coerced or forced into taking these things. Particularly, I mean, I worked on the Gulf War syndrome back in the 1990s, and it became clear through speaking to various victims of that it had been brought on by all sorts of things being pumped into the soldiers all at once, which the body simply couldn't cope with. So if they'd had maybe one at a time, their body would have been fine and their immune system would be able to deal with it. But if you've got, say, 5 or 6 or even 10 different inoculations being stuck into you at once, sometimes you die, basically. Your body just can't cope with all these different diseases that you're being asked to deal with all at once.
Yeah, well, the answer to that is not to invade Iraq in 91. We didn't have to go to war. We chose to go to war. And if you're going to go to war and you're a soldier, they say take the vaccine or you're out of the army or whatever. And that's why, you know, they're not in a position to argue.
I think it was Kuwait, actually.
Yes, I know. But the point is they didn't have to go to war over that. They chose to. And of course, if you choose to do something like going to war, like in World War One with the vaccine for flu, which led to the Spanish flu epidemic, so-called, it was because they wanted to get the troops into the front line as quickly as possible. And they didn't want them to get flu when they got there. So they gave it to them. And then they found out that they were getting serious flu, but they carried on sending them anyway and kept it secret.
Well, it's amazing.
Because they wanted to win the war.
Porton Down, we had Steve Brody on here a couple of months ago taking us through his investigation into Porton Down and the government inquiry into Porton Down, which eventually, this is the Wiltshire-based Chemical and Biological Weapons Centre of the British forces, and yet the connection doesn't seem to be made with between people or by people between the idea of shoving all sorts of substances into soldiers and the potential that this can cause harm. I mean, obviously they're doing that to the soldiers because they think that they want them to be able to be resistant to things out in the battlefield, but you know, it's not the same, is it, as injecting 5 vaccines into a newborn infant.
No, it's not. And in any case, the real problem, I mean, in relation to warfare, is that it's not actually a humanistic activity. Maybe you shouldn't be starting wars in the first place, and then you wouldn't need to rush to fill people up with vaccines, because they knew that Saddam Hussein had chemical and biological weapons because they'd given them to him.
Well, we're getting lots and lots of readings of positive cases in this country, but very, very few deaths. So as the deaths have gone down, around about 5 now a day with COVID-19, as I said, so the number of cases has skyrocketed, and the idea is to test more and more people. Now, looking at the statistics, it looks to me as if the number of cases in Britain or in wherever, Manchester, Warrington, or wherever, Caerphilly, that are starting to go up is directly related to the number of tests being done. So if you're doing more testing, you're going to find more people. So the more testing you doing, the more lockdowns you're going to have, because you're just finding people with this denuded strain of COVID-19. It isn't actually causing anyone to be ill. So it, to me, seems like a very chaotic situation, Martin, where you've got nobody actually ill and yet a whole town can be locked down.
Well, what's happening is the government's trying to make up for the various messes they made earlier in the pandemic.
And don't you think they're having a laugh with us?
No, I think what they're doing is they're trying to... What Boris Johnson and his chums do not want is a massive spike over the winter, which they take the blame for.
But couldn't there be a spike of, say, ordinary flu?
Well, there may well be, and it's going to make it much more complicated to determine which is ordinary flu and which is COVID,
and will it test positive on their tests? Who knows? Anyway, look, this all came up. This, according to Keir Starmer, we're not doing enough testing. 75,000 tests less than we're capable of doing a day, and yet people are being sent all over the country to places you know, many hundreds of miles away from where they actually live to do their tests. Now, personally, if someone asked me to do that, I simply wouldn't do it. I would go to maybe the next day, to especially if I'm not ill. It just seems that we've got a kind of fevered approach to this, if I can use that word, where people are being tested for something which has got no symptoms at all, and they may even be a false positive test that they've got.
Well, there may be false positive tests. That's definitely possible. But of course, the problem with this stuff is that people can be asymptomatic spreaders, and therefore you need to know who those people are. And of course, at one stage, I mean, Matt Hancock yesterday was saying people who haven't got symptoms shouldn't be going.
So,
for
is
a
there
test.
Such a thing as an asymptomatic spreader?
I mean, that's in what
the
it looks like.
Well, I don't think so. No, because you tend to have the symptoms, and then you're generating the virus with the symptoms and spread it then, maybe for 3 or 4 days. That's apparently what the normal COVID is, but if you haven't got any symptoms, then you're very unlikely to be spreading it. Anyway, let's have a listen now to Keir Starmer at Prime Minister's Questions, who was talking about the 75,000 unused tests daily. That does sound like a lot, though, Martin, doesn't it?
Yes, it does, and it's been largely to privatising the whole kit and caboodle.
Mr. Speaker, we all want test, trace and isolate to succeed, and I've offered my support before, but the Prime Minister is ignoring a problem. If people are being told to go hundreds of miles, something is wrong. It's got a lot worse in the last week or two. Everybody in this House knows it because they've all had constituents telling them it. And the Prime Minister talks about capacity. The latest government figures were updated last night. They show that on average, 75,000 tests are not being used every day. If there's 75,000 that are not being used, why yesterday were people being told to go hundreds of miles for a test? Why yesterday were people being told there's no capacity?
Mr. Speaker, the issue at the moment is that there has been a massive increase in the number of people who need or want tests, and particularly people who don't have symptoms. And we need, and I hope he agrees, we need to prioritise people such as NHS frontline staff, our care workers, who urgently need those tests. And as we massively increase the number of tests, it is those groups who are getting priority. And I can just tell him that actually he's wrong in what he says about the failure of NHS test and trace. Let me tell him that of those contacts that supply details, 80% are reached, and 320,000 people have been persuaded to self-isolate and to stop the spread of the disease. That is the British people ignoring his attempt to undermine confidence in test and trace, ignoring his attempt to undermine confidence, and working together to get this disease defeated.
Well, the point about all of this is that the government began the whole process. They didn't have any test and trace in place at the beginning of the pandemic. They then decided that they were going to go to their mates at Serco, who are a private sector organisation that delivers things like to local authorities, so they've got no background in medical stuff at all, and they were given the contract. Dido Harding.
Okay, so that's what came up almost immediately afterwards at PMQs.
£150 million spent on faulty masks, £120 million spent on contracts awarded to a Tory councillor, and a staggering £1 billion worth of contracts awarded without proper due diligence. Where has the money gone, Prime Minister?
Well, Mr. Speaker, all I can tell her is that there's been a massive investment in PPE throughout this pandemic, and billions of items have been supplied. If she has a particular anxiety about some particular contract, then I'm more than happy to address that if she will take the trouble to write to me.
Okay, a couple of things on that. I mean, first, it's quite interesting, isn't it? He's not sounding very confident, but she, I'm not sure who that MP was. I mean, she should be using her opportunity at Prime Minister's Questions to name specific. I mean, he managed to dodge that question quite easily by saying, oh, if she tells me about the specifics, I'll answer her question. But, you know, she could have aired it to the nation what this specific contract is she was talking about. But she just, you know, didn't see. I mean, she's supposed to be one of the top lawyers in the country. She knows that she's covered with parliamentary privilege when she speaks in the House of Commons. She can name these companies. She can name these contracts. And yet she didn't do so, Martin.
Well, you may say so. I didn't know what... I mean, you might have to listen to the whole of what she said.
Well, that was yeah, the whole okay, of what she said.
I take your point, Tony. She should have been naming names there.
Yeah.
But I think
enabled Boris to just sidestep the question and say, yeah, oh, well, indeed. You want to write to me about this on the quiet. That's
but
fine.
If you look at the way Germany dealt with this whole question, they had local testing which was done by local authorities and local infrastructure.
But what about this whole thing?
Like GP surgeries, for example. Why aren't we doing GP surgeries as the place to go and be tested?
Exactly. But very good point. But what about this contract fraud here? Because it looks as if these contracts have just been awarded to Tory mates. I mean, one to a Conservative councillor there. This is going down the road of the sort of levels of corruption that we were seeing in Spain and elsewhere.
Well, the point is that the argument is that because it's an emergency, we can't have proper, tendering and considerations of who's offering the best value.
Due diligence.
Yeah, well, the obvious answer to that is to channel the money through the National Health Service. He knows what the Prime Minister said. He said NHS test and trace. But the NHS has nothing to do with test and trace. It should be, but it ain't.
Also cover PMQs this week is the whole idea of council housing. We'll be talking about this in a little while with Councillor Gary Hopkins here in Bristol. There are some that say that the council housing and the general housing being built now is so inadequate because the planning laws have been so relaxed that they're going to be developing we are right now building the slums of the future.
Kim Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Liverpool in 1869 was the first council to build council housing to replace overcrowded slums. Progress over the years has often been obstructed by this Tory government, most recently with the refusal to extend our most successful landlord licensing scheme and the introduction of permissive development rights, which bypass local control and are likely to create slums of the future. Will the Prime Minister give a straight answer and commit to withdraw these plans and return control back to local communities and prevent a return to the 1860s? Thank you.
This government has already built far more council homes, as far as I can remember, Labour did in 13 years when they were last in office, and we will go on. You've just heard, Mr. Speaker, about the huge £12 billion investment in affordable homes that we're making this week. And we will deliver beautiful new homes across the country, building on brownfield sites in a way that is affordable and helps young people onto the housing ladder in the way that they need, either through affordable rent or through part rent schemes, which are immensely attractive. And that's the way forward for our country.
Well, what he doesn't say there, of course, is that housing is at least 10 times overpriced. So, in other words, you're having to pay 10 times what it actually costs to build a house to buy it. So you've got a massively inflated market there, Martin. But this whole idea of building slums, I look around me in St Paul's here, and I see lots and lots of these student flats going up. I don't think there's any guarantees that all these tens of thousands of Chinese students are going to be coming over to fill all those student flats. One wonders, doesn't one? Because they're all very, very small, pokey little flats where they're actually the student building that we're seeing now. Some of that may become the slums of the future.
Well, it may, and I think the whole thing of affordable housing, obviously, in the eye of the beholder, the purpose of council housing was that it really was genuinely affordable to those on low incomes. And of course, what they're really trying to do is subsidise swing voters who might get a foot on the housing ladder with a help up from the taxpayer, the same people who will then turn around and vote Tory and complain about handouts to the poor.
The irony here is that the government rules when it comes to part financing housing association developments mean that the actual size of the rooms, the quality of the build of the houses for social housing is now sometimes much higher than it is for private house builders.
Well, yes. And, as we know, the housing system in this country has been broken for years. It started getting broken in 1979. There used to be a genuine choice between choosing to rent through the council or buying a house if you felt you had enough money and you wanted to. Whereas now, of course, you have to get on the housing ladder because it's the only way to get a pension. And of course, if you don't get on the housing ladder, you don't get a house and you don't get a pension either.
Freedom of the Press is going to be in the second hour when we talk to Julian Assange's father, but we're also talking about that now. And here we've got the blockade this week. Before we hear the clip from Prime Minister's questions, Martin, what do you make of the Extinction Rebellion's tactic of blocking the distribution of the newspapers?
Well, since the newspapers concerned are, as far as they're concerned, pushing an agenda which is, pro-climate change, It's, I mean, you know, they've been arrested, you know, they can block the road, they get arrested, they get moved. I remember all of the struggles we had over whether pickets could blockade Wapping. We used to go down there every weekend and try and blockade Wapping. And that's because all the 5,000 people have been
sacked. So you were trying to stop the newspapers coming out from Wapping?
Absolutely, because of course if you can stop them, they can lose millions of pounds that evening. So every Saturday we used to go down there, thousands of us, to try and blockade Wapping.
What, the Sunday Times, that would be?
Well, all of Murdoch's press was coming out of there. And of course,
so that's basically, well, you're saying all of them, that's the News of the World and the Sunday Times.
Yeah, well, I mean, the point is that on Saturday night, we were able to get enough people down there to at least delay the lorries, which meant, of course, that they lost money. It wouldn't be, you know, I don't know what the situation would be now, but don't forget 5,000 people have been sacked out of hand with no redundancy payments of any kind, whatever. And that was an industrial dispute.
What was that? Just to take us back to that, because, I mean, I imagine Saturday night in Wapping, there'd be a few people who've had a few pints, actually.
Well, what happened was that they moved all of the printing from Bouverie Street, which was in near Fleet Street, out to Wapping. They sacked all of the existing staff, and they then encamped themselves around the entrances to Wapping. And, of course, in theory, you're only supposed to have six people blocking or they're not blocking the entrance, they're allowed to talk to the lorries coming in and out. But in actual fact, none of that ever happened. There was actual fact lorries driven full belt at pickets, and two people were killed.
Did it achieve anything? I mean, we're talking here about the swap over from the old hot metal printing to desktop published printing as well, aren't we?
Yeah, it was a technological change, but that doesn't mean that your existing staff have to be just thrown overboard with no pensions and off you go. That, you know, basically they walked away with nothing after years of service. And of course, the people who printed the Sun, the guys who printed the Sun, and nearly 100 of them, they were saying when Murdoch bought the Sun, it was losing money massively, and they all mucked in, and they eventually made loads of money for it.
There was actually another change in the way that newspapers and journalism operated at Wapping, because I remember speaking to some people who had worked in the old days and in the new days, and they said one of the most incredible things, and also talking to people who were working in the around about 2010, I was chatting to someone who's working for The Guardian, saying that the weird thing about it all was that the actual deadlines for submitting articles for the paper moved forward. In other words, they were earlier than with the new technology than with the old technology, which I find amazing. But he explained it as follows. What happens is you submit these articles, and then the subs and the editors might well change and alter them. So there's quite a lot of effort goes in between a journalist submitting the article to when it actually gets printed and then distributed late in the evening. Then in the old system where the journalists used to go to the printer, literally a journalist and a printer, the journalist would have their article there, give it to the printer. When the article was ready to be set into the press, the printer would call the journalist. The journalist would then look at a reverse version, you know, if you can imagine, in hot metal, of their article. They'd read it through backwards, and the journalist got quite good at this, reading everything backwards, in complete reverse. And then only when the journalist was happy that the article was the same article that he'd originally written, would he then sign it off, and then that would go into the hot metal and be printed. So even with that old antiquated system, that was a much, much quicker, it got to press quicker than this modern desktop publishing, Martin. It's amazing.
Yeah, well, because that's because, as you say, the subs and the editors want to have control of what's in the articles. So it gave much more power to the management on every level in terms of what went into the paper and in terms of things like pay and conditions and so on.
Yeah, a massive change, of course, is you go to the colour supplements from the Sunday newspapers today. And in the old days, you used to see a lot of news, photojournalism from all over the world, particularly war zones, famine zones, anything big that was going on around the world. You'd see a whole load of pictures from it now. Nothing. It's all just kind of consumer items. So there's been big, big changes in the way the press is operating over the last 30 or 40 years. So let's have a listen now to this Prime Minister's question about Extinction Rebellion and their blockade of the print works.
Deb Sherrill.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. The Prime Minister knows very well I have an 11-year track record of opposing HS2, not least because of the environmental damage it is causing, and have expressed my support for peaceful environmental campaigns against this costly project. Regrettably, the actions of Extinction Rebellion, who've glued themselves to trains and now tried to interfere with the freedom of the press, have tarnished the reputation of peaceful environmental protesters. Will my right honourable friend tell me what options he's considering to ensure, rather than offering encouragement to lawbreakers, this unacceptable behaviour and attacks on our democratic freedoms can be prevented from happening again, and the integrity of peaceful campaigners is not impugned?
Well, Mr. Speaker, I draw a sharp distinction and contrast between the civilised approach of my right honourable friend to environmental protest and that taken by those who has tried in vain to frustrate the freedom of the press. And again, I must say I was struck by the silence of the right honourable gentleman opposite when he had an opportunity to condemn. To answer her point directly, I do think it is important. Now, given the weight of the economic interests that were under threat, and the threat to the freedom of the press, that we look at what we can do under public order and indeed under the law on nuisance. And that is what we will do.
So he's there talking about how dreadful it is that Extinction Rebellion has stopped this wonderful free press. Martin, do we have a free press?
Well, as he said economy first, and then he said, oh, I mean free press. When somebody glues themselves to something, that is not a violent act. It can be obstruction, and you can probably be arrested for it, and you can probably go to court and be fined for it. But to call that violence is just an abuse of the English language.
Do we have a free press, though? I mean,
no, of course we don't. I mean, what we've got is billionaires like Murdoch basically allowed to say what they like and sack their workers at will, as we were talking about earlier.
We also don't, I think, have very much balance. I was listening to the World Service just before I came out here, and there was Stephen Sacker on there with his hard talk, chatting away, for example, to one of the opposition representatives from Belarus. Well, it wasn't hard talk, it was soft talk, basically saying, oh, you know, don't you think, hasn't it been so difficult working with Lukashenko in Belarus, and isn't he isn't it about time that we just had a different government, and the one that even though he was elected, that maybe we should have an exile government for Belarus elsewhere. So what we're getting is very little balanced journalism. All of the major stories that we're seeing seem to be spun one way or another, and it's almost as if we're turning into a kind of propagandistic nation.
Yeah, well, I mean, there never was any freedom of the press in that sense. You know, you can say what you like, but the question is, who's going to hear you? We are sitting here, not being paid, doing this investigative journalism.
There is such a thing as balanced journalism, where you try and make sure that you're putting both sides. Mm-hmm. I mean, we do tend to put maybe a more anti-establishment side on this programme, because we're seeing so much pro-establishment stuff going out in the mainstream press. We're trying to put at least a bit of counter to that. But having said that, in the other interviews that you'll be hearing later, for example, with John Shipton, Julian Assange's father, and the author of COVID-19 Red Pilled, James Perloff, I always try to put opposite points of view. So the idea is you want a broad spread of opinion, and you want to know various opinions within that broad spread. What we're getting now, it's narrowing right down, Martin.
Yeah, but I mean, the fact of the matter is that there's if we were broadcasting on FM here, we would be regulated by Ofcom, as we know, because UK Lawyers for Israel tried to close us down when we were on BCFM.
Well, it's effectively the Israeli government.
Well, indeed.
Which Mondawise very kindly did an article about how UK Lawyers for Israel were funded by them.
But of course, the print press has always been absolutely partisan. They can print anything they like, including lies. And there is no comeback. I mean, when I was working in a school years ago in London, we had a Christmas concert, with the various classes doing various, shows that they put on. And we had one called A Caribbean Christmas. And it was an inner city school. There were plenty of black kids in the school. It was a perfectly normal thing to do. So it was a Caribbean Christmas, and it was a rerun of the 12 Days of Christmas, but it was all Caribbean Five, ripe mangoes, etc. We, little beknown to us, the Sun was sitting at the back of the room, and the front, first few pages of the Sun the next day is parents storm out of politically correct Christmas concert. Which was totally untrue. Nobody had stormed out. And of course, what happened is the head teacher wrote to the Sun and said, well, that's not what happened. Can you please retract? They said no. Yeah, and of course they can print absolute lies, and there's no comeback. And that's not freedom of the press, that's freedom to lie.
I think things did definitely change with Murdoch's arrival in the 1980s, Martin. You're talking about Wapping. That there was something like the idea of, you know, some idea of balance in the press, but it kind of went out. I think it was a big step change. I remember chatting to the former head of HTV, Louis Sherwood, this is probably 15 years ago now, I mentioned Rupert Murdoch as he was driving me along in his car. And as I mentioned Rupert Murdoch's name, he got his fist and he bashed it, or actually his hand, and slapped it on the dashboard of the car really loud, scared me out of my skin. And he said, "Don't ever mention Rupert Murdoch's name to me. That man is poison." Yeah. And there was a whole generation of media people, I think, it, you know, been doing their stuff in the 1960s and 70s, who, when Murdoch arrived in the 80s, were absolutely disgusted.
Yeah, that's true. But if you go back, print press in this country and in many other countries isn't regulated at all, effectively. Anybody can say whatever they like. And what happens is the billionaire owners just push their billionaire views. And, you know, you even when they lie, you've got no comeback on them. So eventually the head teacher in the school I was working in said, "Well, can we have a letter on the letters page saying that, you know, we didn't agree with what you said?" And I said, "No. We've lied, and you've got no comeback."
Well, this is
about the end of it.
This is, I suppose, about rewriting history, isn't it? I'm reminded of things like Stalin, you know, basically rewriting Soviet history as if various leaders like Trotsky, for example, had never existed. You know, this is what they could do in the 1930s.
Well, it's what happened in this country. I mean, if you looked at the press. If you look at the press around the French Revolution, for example, it was hardly fair and balanced. Basically, everybody printed what they wanted, and they accused Marie Antoinette of being a baby eater, and nobody could do much about it.
Well, I'm reminded of Mohamed Rafik, who died recently. We had a clip from him on the show a couple of weeks ago, and you can look up the old clips on Radio 4 All of Mohamed. And he was saying, Martin, I think it would be interesting to know if you agree, he said that there was a sort of period during the 1950s, 60s and 70s where after the Second World War, people were allowed to basically a normal society, a nice, reasonable society where people got had a reasonable chance of a job. And then in the 1980s, the oligarchies began to clamp down again, you know, making it very difficult for people to get jobs and also, clamping down on the free press, effectively.
Yeah, I mean, it's what they call in France les 30 glorieux, the 30 glorious years. And throughout the West, there was a kind of a change in the balance of power, both on the shop floor and in society in general. But, of course, from 1979 onwards, Reagan and Thatcher smashed all of that. And we're living with the consequences now in terms of a completely runaway financial market, which demands huge amounts of taxpayers' money, the privatisation of basic facilities like water and gas, and also, of course, the creation of Al-Qaeda, who are still out there killing our soldiers, even though we train them.
I mean, the maddest thing about the privatisations that have been going on under the Thatcher era, and I did a rather nice RT article about Margaret Thatcher when she died, which has got a timeline. I'll put a link up to it on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. A timeline of the privatisations that happened during the 1980s. It's pretty shocking, and some that happened afterwards. But Margaret Thatcher was privatising all this stuff. The trouble is, Martin, that if you do that, then you stand the chance of having a basic piece of infrastructure that simply goes bankrupt.
It can go bankrupt. And the other thing, of course, is that the profiteering on the infrastructure means that if you are a real, genuine entrepreneurial startup, the price for your telephone, the price for your gas, the price for your electricity is 10, 20, 30 times higher than it should be. And that means when you compete in international markets, you can't compete, which is why we've been in deindustrializing the country.
It's almost a form of sabotage of the nation's infrastructure.
Yeah, but what it is, it's made of making money. This is a rentier economy. It's not an entrepreneurial economy. Entrepreneurs invent new stuff and they need cheap credit and they need cheap infrastructure. A rentier economy is where anything you want to do, especially if you control the monopolies concerned, it just pours money into the pockets of the already wealthy.
I've also just remembered the headline I gave that article, which RT very kindly put up there, was Margaret Thatcher and the Man in the Shadows. And that man in the shadows was Victor Rothschild. Victor Rothschild being a Labour peer, even though he was very, very close to Margaret Thatcher, privatisation was one of his things. Various things like, I mean, I think he got together with William Waldegrave, who lives up on the Mendips here still, and they were behind things like the poll tax. Now, this poll tax community charge, call it what you want, it's turned itself into the council tax, and this is a complete change from the old rate system. So, you know, basically, people who are renting effectively got free water up until this system because the water rates were paid by the house owner who paid the rates. Now everyone is having to pay, even if they've got no income at all, having to pay for water. So there was a big change, wasn't there, that happened with the community charge, poll tax and council tax.
Well, what's effectively happened is taxes have been reduced massively on the rentiers at the top of the pile, and therefore somebody else has got to pay it. That would be the poor mugs at the bottom of the pile.
So let's go and have a listen now to the leader of the Lib Dems here on Bristol City Council, because one of the things that's happening here in Bristol is a new threat to Trinity Pool. I mean, this is up in Knowle, Martin. It's the third time that the City Council has threatened to close this pool, even though before the lockdown it's making a profit. The Mayor, Marvin Rees, so-called Labour Mayor, is now saying, oh, it's got to close.
I don't know anything about it, so let's hear the clip, and then maybe I can comment.
Unfortunately, as well as the lack of actual housing units actually being built. The other problem.
Gary's here talking about the lack of affordable housing, missing the affordable housing targets too.
It's been units at sort of any price. So we've not had the services and the infrastructure put in with the housing. And so one or two developments that have actually been happening are, you know, they're potentially going to be the slums of the future.
Also, Gary, I know you were particularly concerned about Jubilee Pool. I cannot believe this swimming pool, purpose-built, is threatened with closure again. It almost seems like Groundhog Day. As soon as local campaigners and you and the Lib Dems manage to save the pool, there's another threat of closure. Could this really be true?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I mean, this is the third time for me saving this pool. Back in 2010, we actually had the position where because the new Hengrove facility was being built with the PFI, the Labour Cabinet, who had been in until about 2008, they had actually voted for this PFI, which was fine, that was okay in terms of producing the new pool, but they actually voted in there to actually close Jubilee. So when they actually left office a year or so later and we took back over, we had to find a way of rescuing things, which we did. And in 2012, there was some investment put into Jubilee, which saved it for another few years. And then 3 years ago, Marvin decided he wanted to close it down. And we had a fight on our hands then. And he pretended that, oh, no, I hadn't really meant to close it down. That was just an administrative mistake, you know, which was nonsense, of course. And now he's doing it again. He's used the excuse of COVID, which, of course, temporarily the pool had to close, to go for a permanent closure. And has put round literature, which is supposed to be a consultation. In actual fact, it's a complete hatchet job. The community are absolutely furious. I mean, they were very annoyed 3 years ago. They're even more annoyed now, having gone through this fight, having won, to have it happening again. It's just an absolute and utter disgrace.
I mean, what is the justification for closing it this time, though, Gary?
Well, he's saying that he hasn't got any money to do the repairs, which are needed not just on this pool, but across a number of other pools. In fact, this is about the cheapest one to put it to perfect shape.
Well, I mean, this is basically just maintenance, effectively. You know, every piece of infrastructure in the city needs maintenance. And have they just not budgeted for any maintenance?
They haven't done it. Actually, on the PFI, where they had a requirement to pay money in, they've just paid just under £1 million to the operator because of the loss of business. But, of course, with the COVID restrictions on opening, every pool would need a temporary subsidy because they can't have enough customers in to make a profit. Jubilee was actually making a profit prior to COVID. Now, of course, one of the reasons the mayor does have a shortage of cash, he's just lost £50 million quid on Bristol Energy Company. So he hasn't got a few thousand pounds, so he says, left to actually look after facilities that people in the city actually want.
I would imagine it's going to cost more than a couple of thousand pounds, Gary, to do the repairs at Jubilee. Do you have any idea how much they're actually looking for?
There's nothing that's needed to be spent to reopen it now. So there's no immediate requirement for spending. But to give it a 15, 20-year lifespan, so obviously, you know, you need to spend money on making certain something doesn't go wrong in the future, would cost about £250,000. But that's a 20-year lifespan. And actually, but nothing, it said, I've seen the condition report, nothing needs to be spent on it now. But what it would need, as every other pool needs, is a small subsidy to make up for the loss of customers because of COVID.
I mean, one does wonder what people are paying their council tax for if a small subsidy can't come from that to keep swimming pools open.
Well, they're paying for Marvin's private office. They're paying £130,000 for his advisor a year. They're paying enormous amounts of money for redundancy payments for staff. They're paying for more senior staff on even higher wages. And they're paying £50 million for the Bristol Energy Company.
Oh, that's God. Well, I mean, do you think you're going to be able to win this third battle to keep the Jubilee Pool? Are you up for another fight, Gary? Are the local people there up for it?
Oh, they're certainly up for the fight, all right. And, of course, because they know that we won the last two, it's given them a considerable degree of hope. The mayor tried to present this a fait accompli. He's given up on that one now, and he's now trying to say, I don't really want to close it. I want to work with you. But he's shown by his actions to be in exactly the opposite position. So we'll take him at his word. We'll say, this is what you need to do, and let's see if he does it.
So the third battle of Knoll to save the Jubilee Pool, Martin. There's all sorts of questions come out of that, really. One, not least of which, is the Kevin Slocum £130,000, you know, to the advisor to the mayor, and just a fraction of that would save this pool. But it does seem that there's a structural change going on, and it's not all Marvin Rees's fault. A lot of it really is coming from central government, isn't it? Particularly hitting Labour cities the hardest, like ours here in Bristol, where we're being told effectively there will be very few or no local services left after all this austerity.
Well, that's right. And of course, most of the money that local councils spend isn't raised from council tax. It's basically comes from the standard spending assessment, which is central government's allocation to each particular area.
They used
area.
To call it the rate support grant.
Yeah. But the fact is that the Tories are now have definitely decided that they're going to rebalance the every area has got what they call super output areas, which is each tiny little neighbourhood. And if you've got more deprivation, there's a deprivation index. And if you've got more deprivation, you know, more people on free school meals in school, whatever, you get more money. But the Tories over the years, and they're now definitely going to do it, they're going to rebalance it so that rural areas get more money and urban areas get less. And of course, that just means that Tory voters are going to get to keep their local libraries and swimming pools, and people who live in the inner city are going to lose them because they didn't vote Tory.
Well, you can almost you can almost gauge this like a little thermometer based on the rubbish bins and how much they're overflowing or not. So if you go past a rubbish bin and it's all overflowing, you know you're in an area which the Conservative government and our Labour councillor is not supporting.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's basically class war. That's what it is. And if you win the election under first past the post and you've got a majority of 80, you can lash money to you know, a lot of that we were talking earlier about housing. They're basically trying to buy votes from young middle-class people who want to get on the housing ladder. That's where the money's going. Not to take people off the streets in the inner cities, because even if you put them in a house, they ain't going to vote Tory, so what's the point?
I suppose, cynically, the Labour right will be looking at cities like Bristol and saying, well, we don't really need to do anything in Bristol because they're going to vote Labour whatever happens.
Well, that's right. That's why you need to change the electoral system, as it has been changed in Ireland, Scotland and Wales for local elections. And well, of course, that means that people, every vote counts for something. And Gary, as a Liberal Democrat, would no doubt agree with me.
I can tell you,
this.
Up in Knoll, they'll be voting Lib Dem for Gary because of all the things he's done saving the bus routes around there. And when people do that, people actually follow it with voting for them. And then they, then that, but at the end of the day, it's the main thing is the mayor, because the mayor is in control. Anyway, one of the big things, I'm sure if we have Marvin Rees, who doesn't reply to my phone calls, our mayor, in the studio with us today, he'd say, what a great job we're doing in pedestrianising the city centre. And that's something that they've been meaning to do for a long time. The idea is to cut down the amount of fuel emissions and CO2 and carbon monoxide going into the atmosphere in the city centre. And by doing that, there's been a big attempt to get rid of even parking spaces. So what we've seen now, Martin, is roads in the city which have had two lanes are now got one lane, and one of those lanes has got a whole load of bollards. I don't know if you've been driving around and seen this. A whole load of bollards put in this in the middle of the inside lane, so that it's been turned into a cycle lane effectively. So there's now only one lane for the cars. Now this has caused quite a lot of consternation and congestion. But anyway, I put this to Gary. What's going on with these bollards appearing everywhere?
We approve of a number of pedestrianisations in areas, and if they're thought through properly, with the proper look at the consequences, I think a lot of them can be beneficial. Baldwin Street was a very, very serious mistake. The money from government is supposed to be allowing for better cycling and pedestrian facilities. Baldwin Street had about the best of any street in Bristol. A very good cycle lane that had actually been put in at significant cost, decent pavements, and the road was a one-lane road. It was fine. And blocking that off is actually forcing traffic to go on a wide berth and take longer routes. And the problem is doing some of this stuff at a time when people are frightened to go onto public transport, and they're still, enjoying this from government to be careful about public transport, means that we are going to get gridlock in the short term. And that is, a problem that they're going to find very difficult to sort out. Things are actually portrayed as being sort of for the good of the environment, whereas that, in fact, in a number of cases, they're, to try and sort out the financial mess that the mayor's got the city council into.
I mean, it's amazing, really. I've also seen these bollards going up along. It almost seems like maybe the mayor has bought a job lot of bollards and is looking for somewhere to put them, because down in St. Werburgh's along Minor Road, a whole load have appeared along there, which, it was a difficult place for the residents to park anyway. But now with all the bollards down one side of the road, there's simply no space for local residents to park their cars, Gary. Is there anything that we can do in order to try and change this? Because obviously local people who've got vehicles need to be able to park at least somewhere near their home, and they can't do that at the moment.
I'm afraid this is fairly typical of the present administration. We actually, as councillors, you'd expect that we might have had some notification of this. We actually found out about the proposals the day that they were starting to enact them. So basically, I'm afraid that the mayor and his small little group do not listen to any advice. And the problem actually is that, he might well be forced into U-turns on some of these issues. But in the meantime, there's been an awful lot of waste of time and waste of money. Whereas if things were thought through properly in the first place, you wouldn't actually have that.
Now, what is the point of us electing councillors if things are just done, Martin? I mean, it's almost as if this is ruled by the mayor's office and the media. So he makes a big announcement through the media. Local councillors don't know what's going to happen beforehand and have got no chance to have any discussion about it or input. The only thing they seem to get is when something happens, which is a disaster, that there's a petition set up. And then usually after a couple of months, that forces a debate in the council. So democracy is being really trodden underfoot by this mayor.
It's not just by this mayor. The mayoral system was imposed by the Tory Liberal Democrat coalition. If you remember, they were the ones who wanted to have mayors.
Well, actually, it was the people of Bristol voted for it.
Well, only 14% of them. It was nothing like a serious mandate. And, of course, what's the point of, you know, I mean, basically, people didn't really want it, but we ended up with it anyway, because it was an American idea. David Cameron been over to the US, and they have elected mayors there, and what a brilliant idea it would be us to have elected mayors. And the Liberal Democrats, when they were in power, went along with having elected mayors.
This is about centralisation of power, really,
yeah,
isn't it?
It is, and, of course, the idea is that the mayor acts like a CEO of a company instead of the leader of a political group. And therefore, you know, Marvin has the power to do all of these things without consulting councillors. Even if he lost control of the council in terms of the Labour Party losing overall control, Marvin would still have the power given to him by the Tory government. Don't forget, the Tory Liberal Democrat government. He can do what he likes. I don't agree with the mayoral system. I know that Gary doesn't agree with it either, but it was his party that brought it in.
Good point. Anyway, finally, I spoke to Gary about something which is, I think, very, very important. That is to say, the economic disaster that has been the COVID-19 lockdown. That is that where you've got massive companies with enormous monopolies doing extremely well out of this, and small businesses going to the wall.
There is going to be some very, very serious problems over the next few months. People are going to be finding themselves without work. Without means of earning a living, people have got their own businesses, those who are working for others. A lot of it's actually been, you know, delayed by the furlough scheme and the various short-term assistances. But, you know, that's not the long-term solution. What concerns me is that what some of the money that's actually been put in by government has actually been used to prop up large businesses rather than which possibly in some cases have very little chance of now standing on their own 2 feet. But there seems to be little effort in terms of investing in the new infrastructure that's going to be required. So, for example, you know, we are going to need investment into more renewable energy schemes, but I don't see much of that sort of thing happening. And some of the people have been, you know, making aircraft wings or whatever, which are probably not going to be in huge demand over the next year or two, they could be using their skills more productively for the future. But I don't see that sort of imagination either nationally or in local administration.
Well, he's put his finger on it there. The fact is that lots of the macroeconomics of the situation we are in mean that large numbers of people are going to lose their jobs because in the current setup, their jobs are no longer needed, whether they're small businesses or large businesses. And that's because we bailed the banks out in 2008. That's where the money went, folks. And that's why the money that we need a plan to redevelop the economy on different lines. And in actual fact, the Labour Party put forward such a plan, but we didn't win the election because it's the first past the post election.
No, it's because Jeremy Corbyn rejected the referendum result.
No, he didn't. He actually did accept the referendum result. You could argue that about Keir Starmer. You can't argue that about Corbyn. The point is that we need a vision for the future. He's right about that. But we haven't got one. I tell you who has got a vision for the future is the Chinese Communist Party, because they're socialists, unlike the people who run this country. I mean, Gary's talking about there, he's saying, let's not bother subsidising Airbus. Well, he may be right about that. Maybe Airbus is going to go down the drain. But why should we subsidise somebody's small business as well? That business may go down the drain as well. And in other words, we're picking winners. So we're not leaving it to the market. Somebody's got to have a plan. That plan is called socialism, and you've got to have a plan for doing things. You can't just leave it to the market. And, of course, that's not Liberal Democrat philosophy. They believe in the market, ultimately, and they ultimately believe in bailing out the banks as well. I mean, I get a bit annoyed with the Liberal Democrats moaning and groaning about all of this stuff. They went into coalition with the Tory government, which lost the country's AAA credit rating by putting too much emphasis on austerity. So they even lost the country's credit rating by doing that, which shows their economic illiteracy.
It's fair to say Gary and many other Lib Dems were not at all happy with Nick Clegg as a leader.
No. I mean, when Nick Clegg just had been elected as the leader and had just gone into coalition, if you remember, I interviewed him for this show and I put it to him that he was going to lose the country's credit rating, and he didn't even understand the question. never mind answer it.
Yeah, well, he's another puppet politician. Anyway, talking of which, Matt Hancock this week was ticked off by the Speaker because, as the Speaker explains here, this is about a minute and a half, this clip, that he's basically running the country by press release rather than going through Parliament.
Mr. Desmond Sway.
Had the Secretary of State for Health given notice of the government's intention to further restrict our liberty to meet with one another in his statement yesterday, at least some of us would have been able to question him about it. What remedy is there for those of us who enthusiastically support the Prime Minister, but nevertheless want to restrain the government's ability to govern by order without debate?
Can I say thank you to the Right Honourable Member for giving me notice? I'm very sympathetic with the main point he makes. I accept the decisions have been taken in a fast-moving situation, but timings for statements are known to ministers. It's really not good enough for the government to make decisions of this kind in the way which show insufficient regard for the importance of major policy announcements being made first to this House and to members of this House wherever possible. Can I say to him, I've already sent a letter to the Secretary of State. I think the total disregard for this chamber is not acceptable. I know the Prime Minister is a member of Parliament as well, and he will ensure that statements should be made here first, especially as this particular Secretary of State requests statements and then to ignore the major fact that he wanted to put to the country. Not before this House is not acceptable, and I hope he will apologise to members.
So that's quite a strict ticking off there by the Speaker, Matt Hancock, specifically, basically calling him a hypocrite. He's expecting everyone else to go through him and the House of Commons before announcing things, but yet he is going straight to the newspapers and saying things like, OK, we're changing all the rules to do with the so-called pandemic, which is finished in June, saying that everyone is going to be only allowed to have six people meeting together, and they're not having any kind of discussion or debate. It's a rule by edict. That's effectively what the Speaker's saying there.
Well, do you know what I suspect has happened here? Matt Hancock didn't know what the decision was when he went to Parliament yesterday or the day before, and then he was told afterwards by Cummings what the decision was. That's what's going on here.
So how's that, you know, is it Cummings is making all these decisions, you think? And surely he understands that it's only going to cause flak if it doesn't go through Parliament first.
No, Cummings has got contempt
for Parliament. An announcement to Parliament.
Cummings has got contempt for Parliament, as we saw during the prorogation debate. They are trying to rule by decree, that's quite clear, but I don't think Matt Hancock is the guilty party. I think he's just an errand boy. He was told to go to Parliament and bluster, which he did, and then after he'd done that, they were told, we're not doing that anyway, we're going to do something else, and then he's got to go back and change what he's saying, because he don't make the decisions.
Interesting. Anyway, so staying with the COVID, we had an interview last week, and I'll put a full interview up this week on our show page at thisweek.org.uk with the psychological warfare officer, Scott Bennett. And here, Martin, and it'd be interesting to see what you make of this, is he thinks that the whole COVID business has been a psychological warfare operation. I suppose he would say that, being a psychological warfare officer. And that actually it's been an enormous blunder, in that the World Health Organization, the Gates Foundation, etc., have really overstretched themselves.
They've grossly overstepped their bounds. This is a push towards fascism and a testing to see how people respond. Megan Whitmer of Michigan, shutting down football, shutting down churches, arresting people who go into congregations and these sort of things. The same thing being done in New Jersey by Murphy, the governor who shuts down a gym and throws the men in court and tries to imprison them for opening their gym. The attorney generals and the attorneys that prosecute hairdressers who have to work to feed their children, they're thrown in jail and go through the court system. This is what revolutions are made of. This is the substance of civil wars. This is the ignition for both revolutions and renaissance. And I think I would like to think that we're on the verge of a renaissance, because there are more intelligent people who value their freedom and their independence and have critical thinking and go, you know what? I have not been sick. My family hasn't been sick. If I did catch a flu, maybe I took propolis, oregano oil, vitamin C, and maybe hydroxychloroquine if it was serious, but I'm not losing my teeth or going blind or melting into a zombie. So this claim of otherwise is all propaganda.
So that's Scott Bennett. Martin, he's really painting quite an extreme point of view there and saying the whole thing has been a psyop. Yes, there obviously have been some people die, but that's now completely finished. This is now becoming just an exercise in trying to control people.
Well, he's a psychological warfare officer, not a doctor. That's the first point I'd make. The second point is the Chinese Communist Party treated it as a biological warfare attack on them, which I think it was. And the purpose of a biological warfare attack isn't to kill everybody, it's to wreck the economy. But the Chinese economy is bouncing back because they haven't got any issues with COVID
anymore.
Well, the
idea is if you have a lockdown, you're going to wreck the economy. There's a lot of people saying that there was no need for a lockdown, not least of which is the Swedish government. Now, they're not known for their reckless attitude. They've thought this through. And I just noticed last week that their chief epidemiologist has just been promoted to a top position in the World Health Organization. So it's not as if the international health people don't recognize that what Sweden has done is an intelligent response.
But in Sweden, you're still not having any football and no meetings of people more than 50. What they said at the beginning is we're going to have a limited lockdown because we're going to be able to sustain this as long as necessary. What we had in this country is no lockdown at all, followed by a complete lockdown, which was no use because the horse had already bolted. In China, even where this supposedly started, they treated it as a biological warfare attack from the get-go. They've had less than 5,000 deaths. We've had 50,000 deaths in this country,
well,
much smaller country.
You talking about biological warfare attack, this is exactly what I put to Scott, the $64,000 question of whether COVID is man-made or not.
What about the $64,000 question about COVID-19? Is this a man-made virus or is it naturally occurring? No one really seems to have actually answered that one yet.
I think it's man-made, of course. I think when you look at the scientific analysis of it, the medical analysis, the characteristics are not consistent with a natural virus. They are more characteristic of a AIDS hybrid sort of a virus. So, again, I think that needs to be examined and looked at. But the overwhelming evidence that I've seen is, one, this is man-made. Two, did it come from Wuhan or did it come from North Carolina in a military weapons depot? Why does Dr. Fauci, this guy who I think is really a criminal and is being exposed increasingly as a fraud, why does he have photos of him in very dubious places with Barack Obama? Why is Fauci predicting pandemics like this back in 2017? Why is he predicting, I think it was in October, November of 2019, before this all came out, using language that was very suspicious and seemed to indicate that a pandemic was inevitable and it was coming out? Why does Dr. Fauci and Bill Gates have photographs of each other standing and joking and all sorts of jocular interactions? Why is this vaccine and the wearing of masks and the elimination of handshakes and all sorts of other draconian human alteration of relations, why is that being pushed? I think it is a psychological operation to break people down, to dehumanize them, and using a virus is the easiest way because the average person, Tony, is not attentive enough or smart enough or has the gumption or the moxie or the energy to challenge what is being told to them. You see it all the time. 70% of human beings don't challenge what they're told. And here's the other failure you're seeing in the churches, the religious establishments, which are supposed to be representing and defending the spiritual and the moral and the freedoms and the liberties of human beings and their rights in America, the American churches. They've all surrendered. They've all put up their clothes for business sign. They've all bought into, we do what the government tells us. Well, when the government becomes a draconian fascist, propagandistic machine run by algorithms and big tech psyop communities, you can't trust anything that's given to you. And yet the American churches have been totally silent and totally imploded in submission to this hysteria.
That's a pretty comprehensive takedown of this. He believes it's a psychological warfare operation, Martin. Why don't you?
I think it's a biological warfare attack which leads to a psychological warfare operation. As we know, the Times of Israel told us that the Defense Intelligence Agency of the United States warned the Israeli Defense Forces in November 2019 that a pandemic was coming out of China. How did they know? Because they probably seeded it. As he said, it probably came from North Carolina. The purpose of this is because there was a crash in the stock market in September. The repo market started to collapse just like in 2008. And if they had to turn around and say to the people, we're going to have to bail the banks out again, there would have been a scream of fury. But in actual fact, if we've got a pandemic, they can bail the banks out, and it just looks as if they're doing it because of COVID. And of course, the other thing is to try and stop the Chinese taking over the world economy, which is what they're preparing to do.
Well, that certainly seems to have been a big effect of this. It's stopped the Chinese in their tracks, apparently.
Their economy is bouncing back now because they treat it as a biological warfare attack, and they've managed to squeeze it out of the system. So their ships, for example, if there's any fighting in the South China Sea, are completely COVID-free. That's not true of the US Navy.
Well, it'd be interesting to see whether there's any truth to that. You know, if you've got some parts of the world's soldiers, and I imagine that the people making vaccines will be thinking, well, we must get into the soldiers first. I mean, that seems to be, you know, if there is any fighting goes on, you want to make sure your soldiers are not going to get hit with some sort of COVID thing.
What is interesting is that both the Russians said that they had developed a vaccine, or that they're about to test it, and then the US puts sanctions on the facilities, which are government owned in Russia, so they're not doing it for private profit, and they were prepared to announce what they'd done, and they said, we're happy to share this with everybody else. And then the US government put sanctions on the laboratories which had developed it on the grounds that they were chemical warfare
What do you make of what he was saying about the church there? Because, you know, what he's saying is that there is a spiritual element to this. The idea is it's an attempt to isolate people. I mean, that certainly happened for elderly people who've been dying in care homes. I mean, this is barbaric, leaving people to die with no contact whatsoever with their family.
Well, I mean, the situation is very bad in all sorts of different ways. If it's a biological warfare attack on the Chinese, which they thwarted, it's quite likely that we're going to end up at war.
What about the human side of this, though? The barbaric side of leaving people to die with no contact with their family?
Well, I totally agree.
This has never happened in the history of humanity.
Well, no. I mean, you'll find that in previous pandemics, and don't forget, pandemics were used, because of modern medicine, people got used to the idea that pandemics don't happen.
So you think it
historically
has,
they
you
did
You think
happen.
This is normal, then, in a pandemic, for someone to be told, you're just going to have to die on your own in a hospital bed with your family can't see you?
Listen, back in the day, people didn't die in hospital beds. They died in the street. What used to happen in pandemics, and there was many...
You're avoiding the question, aren't you? Elderly people dying with no family anywhere near them. This has never happened before.
No, it has happened before. That's why I'm not avoiding the question. I'm trying to point out that it has happened before. Previously, what used to happen in London and Bristol when we had pandemics is people were nailed into their own houses and they weren't allowed out at all. They were left to die. And that was the way you dealt with it. And of course, modern medicine, there's some attempt to try and help people. In the past, they didn't even try and help. They just made sure that they locked the gates. And people who were inside were banged up in their houses, and they died in the houses. That's how it used to be dealt with.
So this is a bit of a medieval way to deal with
this. Well, I'm just saying that's what used to happen.
For a so-called pandemic where it hasn't actually killed anywhere near as many people as the flu did in 2017.
Or in 1918.
It's completely different. Hang on, the figures are completely different for the Spanish flu and the flu in 2017, 2018.
The point about this, if it's a biological warfare attack, Tony, is it's not designed to kill loads and loads
of
people.
And the point about it, Martin, if it's a psychological warfare attack, is that the idea is to isolate and confuse people.
Yes, and therefore allow them to bail the banks out and try and wreck the Chinese economy. So they've got two goals, wreck the Chinese economy. They've failed in that one because the Chinese were too smart. And the other thing is to make people feel that there's a massive pandemic going on so that they can bail the banks out. That's what's going on here.
Okay, well, the one person that is very interested in the spiritual side of things, and I came across him here in Bristol City Centre, is Sean Miriam O'Sullivan. He's what he calls himself a street preacher. And quite often you see people preaching in the streets and people are kind of walking past, whereas Sean have managed to attract quite a big crowd. I'm talking about maybe something like 40 or 50 people in Broadmead, and they were listening to him. Most of the people were listening to him. In fact, he was even getting a few rounds of applause from people, and he was having a few disputes with people who were saying, oh, don't be silly, there's no such thing as God, etc. But when he was preaching down in Swindon a few months ago, he had an altercation with a Muslim. And so let's have a listen now to Sean talking about an upcoming court case that's going to be taking place next year. I spoke to him a few weeks ago about what is at the nub of this case.
So I was out preaching the gospel. I said, Jesus Christ is the way.
This is in Swindon.
This is in Swindon. My family come with me. My wife went out and handed out some tracts on the other side. So I was talking about Jesus. You know, people don't want to just set things. They want to know why. So this woman said, you know, Muhammad is the truth. So I gave her a story like Jesus talked in stories. So I just used the life of Christ and what Christ went around doing. And I shared what Muhammad did. And I said, today, would you find him not guilty or not guilty? And she wouldn't answer the question. But the police turned up and they arrested me without warning. They didn't tell me to stop. The crowd wasn't even arguing. Actually, when I got arrested, the crowd was saying, this guy's done nothing wrong. Why are you arresting him? And it was really, the officer looked very shocked. When I got to the police station, they read out my charges. He didn't look very happy, but obviously he's not going to shame his colleague. But yeah, pray for me, because my trial's coming up. We're looking for anyone that wants to come there who believes in freedom of speech to come out and be a voice and be heard.
We kept him for 12 hours and then released in the middle of the night.
Yeah, I was in there for 12 hours, and my son was very young then. He was a premature baby. He died on arrival. He was resuscitated. And my wife was on life support machine, and my son was on life support machine. So my son needed special formula milk. He was only supposed to be gone for 3 hours. And I did tell the police this many times, that I need to get to my family. But they said, okay. It was very, very heartbreaking for me. I had to walk 10 miles in the rain, and I felt such a failure to my family. And I was really ashamed of the police force for doing that.
But I mean, surely it's bound to be offensive to a Muslim to say to their face, Muhammad is a false prophet.
Yeah, of course it is.
I mean, it's like someone saying to you, Jesus is a false prophet.
Yeah, and people say that every single day. But, you know, we do have a freedom of speech in this country. And but this person was mocking Jesus Christ as well. They were saying really rude things. They asked me the question. I gave them the question. I don't go out there and shout, Muhammad is a false prophet. If they ask me a question, I will read, tell them things that's in the Quran and in the Bible.
Well, hang on a minute, because there's nothing about Muhammad in the Bible. I mean, that's hundreds of years after the Bible.
Yeah, he's in the Quran. So I read out the Quran and I shared some things. I always do many times because people want to know. They say that Muhammad was more peaceful and loving than Jesus.
So can you just sum up, what are you being actually charged with?
Racism and offending someone.
So that's Sean Miriam O'Sullivan. His trial's next year sometime. I was chatting to him earlier this week. Martin, this is a bit of a difficult one, isn't it? You know, you could say Buddha is a false prophet. You could say Moses is a false prophet. Is that freedom of speech or is that offensive?
I would argue that people should be able to say whatever they want to say about this. It shouldn't be a matter of for the courts if people want to argue about religious things.
They're talking about offending a protected group, effectively.
Well, I mean, if you...
Say, for example, depends, Moses. If you're saying Moses is a false prophet, that could be construed as anti-Semitic, for example.
Well, it could, yeah. I mean, the thing is, there's having a legitimate religious dispute, and there's, you know, using language likely to cause a breach of the peace because you're being very offensive, you know. And there are limits to freedom of speech. We all know there are. We're not on Ofcom now, so I could swear and about anything and so on. But I generally don't, because, you know, there's no reason to provoke people if you don't need to. And basically, freedom of speech, if we're going to have anybody saying anything, then it's got to be absolutely anything. And if it's not going to be absolutely anything, we've got to have some rules about what is and what isn't acceptable.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? We had John Wesley, people like that, you know, here in Bristol, giving their sermons as...
and they used to be attacked by people who didn't agree with them. We used to throw bricks at them and so on. Well, totally wrong.
In which case the police would and should you know, be intervening.
Well, that's what, that didn't like happen that. At the time. Wesley's people, these the landowners and the bosses didn't like him preaching in the street, and they used to bring gangs of thugs along to prevent him. So the new rooms where he used to preach has got no windows on the ground floor, because the people who didn't like the Methodists used to come and chuck things at them, and therefore they didn't want windows on the ground floor.
So
there's this kind of thing. People tend to have quite strong feelings about religion, which is why there are some rules about what you can and can't say in public, because it's a public order thing. You know, if everybody's going to start screaming and shouting at each other, it's going to turn into a fight like in Birmingham.
You know, maybe Ian Paisley in Bristol City Centre could ruffle a few feathers. But ultimately, saying that Muhammad is a false prophet, do you think that the police should arrest someone for saying
I think that's a legitimate dispute, a religious dispute. He might say that, and she, and you know, the Muslim view would be different, but then of course it would be, for obvious reasons.
So if you want to see Sean Miriam O'Sullivan, I will put a link up to his, I think it's a Facebook page he's got or something, on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. And also, of course, you may just bump into him if you're out shopping in Bristol City Centre. This is the sort of thing, Martin, which I suppose the lockdowns, the pandemic, is almost bound to bring people like this out. And what impressed me more than anything else was that actually he had an attentive crowd for a change.
Well, I'm all in favour of people going and speaking in public about what they believe. I've done it many times myself, and I think it's a perfectly legitimate activity.
Well, we're going to finish off the first hour with listen to a chap called James Perloff, who I interviewed earlier this week. Now, he's brought out a book all about COVID-19. It's called COVID-19 Red Pilled.
My name is James Perloff, P-E-R-L-O-F-F. I've been a journalist since 1985 when I started writing for the New American Magazine. And I guess you could say that I've been red-pilled since 1978 when I read Gary Allen's book, None Dare Call a Conspiracy. I've written a few books over the years, such as Tornado in a Junkyard, The Case Against Darwin. I've written a primer on the New World Order called Truth is a Lonely Warrior, which came out in 2013. And that was supplemented by a book last year called 13 Pieces of the Jigsaw. And I was working on a book on 9/11, but got diverted by the urgency of this COVID crisis, which is really, they're using as a pretext to bring on the New World Order very, very fast. So I do have a brand new book out. It's called COVID-19 and the Agendas to Come Red-Pilled. Part four of my book is called The Deep State's Endgame, and deep state being one of the words used for this oligarchy, but I have a chapter on population reduction, a full chapter on Bill Gates and all the stuff he's up to. I have a chapter on the plan for global vaccination. I have one called 8 Reasons Why We Don't Need a COVID Vaccine. I have one chapter just on hydroxychloroquine, because so much has been done to try and stop use of hydroxychloroquine, which threatens the need for a global vaccine. I also have a chapter on the plan for a global digital ID. We see Microsoft allied, for example, with the Global 2020 Alliance to establish a universal global ID, and also a cashless society. The journal Euromoney recently had an article where they're saying that COVID was making cash unnecessary in many countries, because after all, you know, money could have the COVID germs on it. So why do we need to have cash in the first place? But that has also been integrated right now in West Africa, where you see the Gavi Alliance, the Bill Gates Vaccine Alliance, is working with MasterCard and a AI company called Trust Stamp, so that people will have a digital record, not only of their vaccination record, but their financial record. And that really brings, again, to the fore the whole idea of a mark of the beast, where you can't buy or sell unless you've got the mark. And in that section, I also have a chapter on contact tracing and the surveillance state.
Well, one word you mentioned there, Bill Gates. What do you think his role is? Because he comes across as, you know, quite an affable, benevolent chap, even though, of course, he's one of the richest men in the world. What's Bill Gates' role in all of this?
Well, he seems to be the chief spokesman for what the agenda should be. He appears throughout the mainstream media, especially here in America. And he's been involved with a lot of bad things. One thing I noticed about Bill Gates is that he doesn't like anything natural. excuse me, in quoting the mainstream media, you know, I point out that he's got, well, his Gates Foundation has got 5.3 million shares of Crown Castle, which is a 5G infrastructure builder. He's invested in half a million shares of Monsanto, now owned, by, of course, by Bayer, but they're the makers of glyphosate, which cause very carcinogenic, as well as GMOs. And, you know, you're talking about transhumanism, the transspeciesism, you know, GMOs are changing the way seeds are made. And also he's producing lab-grown meat to replace the meat that we eat. He's investing in artificial breast milk for babies. And he's even got a plan, this is in the British press, to block the sun with, you know, reduce the sunlight with millions of tons of dust being spread in the atmosphere. So he doesn't like anything natural, whether it's in nature or the human body or food. He hates it. And yet he's the one, he's stated that he's invested in 7 COVID vaccine factories. One of them, of course, is the one I mentioned, Moderna, which is making this mRNA, this transhumanizing vaccine. And he is at the forefront of this drive to change the world and bring about this cashless digital ID mandatory global vaccine state.
He's obviously a very pro-vaccine guy, but you say you've got a chapter in your book all about, was it 8 reasons not to have a vaccine? It'd be very interesting to hear. Can you just run through those? Because for most people, they think that if there's a pandemic around, a vaccine is the obvious thing to do, but you don't agree. So why don't you agree?
Okay, well, all right, the 8 reasons. First of all, Stanford University did a study that showed that the maximum death rate from COVID is 0.2%, would be 99.8% survival rate. But the CDC back in May said the death rate from COVID is only 0.26%, which means you've got a survival rate of 99.74% without a vaccine. So why should we have a mandatory vaccine if it we can survive so well without it? Plus the fact that the coronavirus keeps mutating. I quote an Italian nanopathologist named Stefano Montanari. He says if he proposed a coronavirus vaccine as a student, he'd been kicked out of class because the coronavirus keeps mutating. That's why we never get immune to the common cold, and that's why we never had a vaccine for the common cold. It gets mutating. So if you do make a coronavirus vaccine, you're going to need a new one every few months because it keeps mutating. But reason number 3, there are a number of epidemiologists, including some I quote from Oxford, that say that the coronavirus is basically COVID-19, as we know it, is disappearing or disappeared already. Number 4, we already touched on the fact that countries like Sweden and Taiwan have flattened the curve without a vaccine. Also, number 5, I quote Dr. Richard Bartlett of Odessa, Texas, who's had 100% success treating COVID with inhalers or nebulizers. Number 6, Northwestern University in the United States has shown there's a significant correlation with COVID death and vitamin D deficiency. In other words, if you're not vitamin D deficient, you're very unlikely to die from it. Number 7, we've already gotten into, but the very fact that these DNA, mRNA vaccines are changing your DNA, this has never been done before. We've never had these before. They're entirely experimental. Why would you want to mess with your DNA when we have a 99.74% survival
well, hang
rate?
On, because they're not experimental. Yeah. They're doing proper trials on them first before releasing them to the public.
Well, Dr. Kerry Madej, who I quote in my book, would disagree with that. She says that you should be doing animal trials first. That's the standard process. But they're going straight to humans, and they're having a lot of failures, by the way, a lot of people having severe reactions from these. And since the coronavirus appears to be disappearing and we have such a high survival rate, why would you want to, as the White House puts it, bring about a vaccine at warp speed? That's how they've been putting it. The other thing is that when they tried to develop a SARS vaccine, and SARS is, according to The Lancet, is 79% genetically similar to COVID, they got a terrible reaction in the animals. They had a very robust antibody reaction, but when they encountered the real virus, the actual virus, they went into cytokine storm, which is what makes COVID so deadly for a few people. Cytokine storm is an autoimmune reaction in the lungs. So again, these are 8 reasons. That's not even including hydroxychloroquine, which I devoted an entire chapter to. But those are some of the reasons we certainly don't need a COVID vaccine.
You've hinted here and certainly in your stuff about the Bible, etc., intelligent design. And you know, we're looking at people like Gates, basically in the transhumanist, saying that human beings can be genetically engineered to make them better. You're arguing, and I think I would argue too, that actually we're created in a rather fine fashion anyway. And a lot of this tinkering is likely to lead to actually worse outcomes. For example, through genetically engineered crops, we've seen the Terminator technology coming in so that every person who's growing food has to go to some crop company, one of the massive ones, I imagine, in order to get the seeds. They cannot grow their own seeds because everything that starts to grow is then infertile. So there is definitely a dark side to this genetically engineered way of doing things. I wonder though, if for someone coming at this who hasn't really had much of a discussion, even at school sometimes, about the idea of intelligent design, what would you point to say, well, actually, here is some real evidence that points to intelligent design that you probably haven't ever been exposed to in school?
We are marvelously designed. We have a tremendous immune systems, and I wrote a book in 1998 called "Tornado in a Junkyard," which so many things come out of Britain, whether it's Marx or the Beatles or Darwin. But Darwin's work was actually a house of cards. Certainly, there's such a thing as natural selection, but you won't get one type of animal macro evolving into another type. That's all speculation on Darwin's part. You certainly, God gave us smart genes, which enable us to adapt to our environment. So a mother can, if she has a premature baby, her milk will adapt to that situation and give the baby the right enzymes and other nutrients it needs. And if we have an infection, our body produces more white blood cells. We can adapt to a situation, but we don't adapt from fish to people. That was Darwin's basic mistake, was saying that we make these gigantic leaps of evolution, for which he had no evidence for. But yes, we are marvelously designed, created in God's image as human beings. And again, this is going back to what we said before. This is not something to go into my book, COVID-19 Red Pill, because it's just I'm not trying to hit people with things that are a little too spiritual. I'm just trying to stick with the facts and the quotes from the scientists. There is definitely a transhumanistic aspect to this that we want to stay away from. We want to stay away from the types of things that we've seen occurred in the past.
Okay. The other thing, which I think many people will recognize, James, 100%, is this push towards a cashless society. Why should we be concerned about that, though? Because it's a lot more convenient to wave a little credit card or your hand, a microchip in your hand, in order to pay for something, than it is to, go through cash and withdraw it from the bank. It means, it's actually a hell of a lot more convenient.
Well, the problem is that it's very easy to take it away from you. We went from, here in America, we had gold and silver coins. And then in 1933, President Franklin D. Roosevelt, at the behest of the bankers, did away with that. He forced everyone to turn in their gold and silver. And then lo and behold, he about doubled the price of gold after everyone had turned it in, which is very pleasing that the bankers had got hold of it. Some people say that Fort Knox is empty of gold, and I've even talked to soldiers at Garda who say that that's privately known. But we went from gold and silver to paper money, and then we went to digital currency. The problem with digital currency is when your entire life's work is represented by nothing but a few digits in an online bank, it's very easy for some government bureaucrat to just erase that. We see that I'll give you an example. I was on a podcast. Well, I take it back. I was talking to a podcast host over dinner the other night, and he told me about a friend of his who was in China who was caught jaywalking. This is quite recent. And the way he was caught jaywalking was through facial recognition. And then the penalty for jaywalking was digitally removed from his account. Now, with the totalitarian governments, you can see how they could use this system to bankrupt you overnight. If your wealth is represented by not by real money, but by by just these this cashless system, they could take it away from you just like that. You know, like in China, where the social credit scores, you know, if you have a good social credit score, you're a good boy or girl, you obey the government, you'll be able to travel, you'll be able to do things, you'll be able to shop. But if you're not, they'll take that away. So the risk, in spite of the, there's always going to be, you know, there's, sure, there's convenience. To get a mouse into a trap, you've got to put cheese there. And so the cheese is the convenience. But the fact of the matter is if you make everything cashless, the government, these governments, which, as we can see, the evidence that they're turning increasingly police state-like, Orwellian and totalitarian, they can take away your wealth with a few keystrokes. And that is something we certainly don't want.
So that's James Perloff there, author of the book I'm holding in my hand here, COVID-19 and the Agenda to Come, Red Pilled. Martin, he talks about all sorts of different aspects there, but I wonder if you could just address this one. He actually thinks that this is against intelligent design, that you're saying that actually we are well made. Human beings don't need all these RNA vaccines and things like that. That by working with our natural immune system, that's a better way, a better approach. I suppose, generally speaking, this is the kind of approach that the Swedes have taken.
Well, I don't think the Swedes are in favour of intelligent design because they didn't have a lockdown.
No, I'm talking about working with the human immune system rather than trying to have a vaccine or some technical solution.
Well, as he said there, the book he's written about COVID doesn't really have much about intelligent design in it. We can address intelligent design if you like, because obviously he's a believer in intelligent design. We've had this debate before. I'm not. I actually believe we are evolved from fish. I'm sorry. And that's the mainstream view of mainstream biology, I'm afraid.
Okay, what about China then? Because he's saying this is, and I suppose this is a harder, more specific point, is that if we're moving towards a cashless society, then as happens now in China, you don't have anything of value. You just have a kind of social credit score, and it can be removed at the drop of a hat.
Well, that is the Chinese system. And before they had modern technology, they had all sorts of other mechanisms for keeping people in line, you know, struggle sessions, etc. It's a communist setup. I think what's very interesting with the cashless society thing is that when Narendra Modi in India get rid of cash, large note cash. And of course in India, which is a very much less developed society than China in many respects, lots of people haven't got bank accounts, lots of people haven't got electricity. So the idea of bringing in getting rid of cash in India was absolutely disastrous and caused all sorts of problems for small businesses and poor people in rural areas.
Oh, and helped all the big businesses. That's funny.
Well, indeed, yes. And it was actually pushed through by USAID, which is a front for the US deep state. And Modi,
well, it's a State Department, isn't it?
Well, yeah, but I mean, it's basically the USAID is supposedly helping people, but it's basically using US taxpayers' money to push an agenda. And they were the ones who wanted India to experiment with having no big notes of cash. And Modi at the time said, well, we're trying to get rid of corruption, etc. But it actually caused a massive shock, and lots of small businesses which relied on cash poor people who didn't have bank accounts were severely affected, and eventually they had to row back on it. China, on the other hand, is a more developed country than India, largely and of course before modern technology like the social credit scores that they've now got. Basically, the Chinese Communist Party used to control things pretty tightly anyway. They always did, and they still do.
Anyway, there's another chapter. Chapter 23 in this book is about the global digital ID. Now, this is a deadly serious part of all of this. That is to say, effectively, you're not going to be able to go back to normal until you've got this digital ID. It's a kind of vaccine passport.
Yeah, I think they want digital ID, and they want the vaccine people are pushing a digital ID because they want digital ID anyway.
This is a bit like the ID card struggle we had with Gordon Brown, isn't it?
It is, except it's more pernicious because
it's global too.
Yes, and it's actually something that you can't, you know, you can throw an ID card away or forge one. You can't forge a chip that's inside you, can you?
Well, if it's inside or outside, that's another question, but the idea is really that this is going to be a global system and that we will not be able to do basic things like travel. Now, this almost seems as if China has been used as a template here, and the template that they've got in China, which is what this social credit does, it doesn't allow you to travel unless you've got a good social credit score, is being rolled out right across the world.
Well, I mean, in many ways, the Chinese communist system is a bit like feudalism. You're not allowed to change. For example, they didn't have a big rush into the major cities because people basically have to stay where they were born unless they've got a permission to move. And you could say that's a terrible system, but in many ways, it's actually worked for China. They haven't got massive slums in their major cities as they have in Brazil and elsewhere.
Well, just being able to travel doesn't mean to say you're going to create a slum, does it?
No, but the point is that they've got a much more controlled system in China. They always did, even before the Communist Party took over.
Yes,
they had a more controlled system.
I noticed
that's part of their culture.
In other parts of the world, that the Chinese are very much into wearing masks, which now also seem to have spread over here. But anyway, the full interview with James Perloff, which includes, I thought, a fascinating excursus into the idea of genetic engineering being discussed in the pseudepigrapha of the Bible, things like the Book of Enoch, Jubilees and things like that. I found absolutely fascinating. I'll put that up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. So it's a 45-50 minute interview altogether, so we don't have time for all that now, but that will be up later this evening on our show page. So thanks to Martin Summers and also to our Lib Dem councillor for Knowle, Gary Hopkins. You can join us in a minute as we take our weekly look around the world. Sounds like a